And now, for our feature presentation. Graphic Audio. A movie in your mind. Graphic Audio presents William W. Johnstone's Scream of Eagles. Narrated by Mort Shelby. With performances by David Coyne, Terence Hazelford, Nanette Savard, Richard Rowan, Thomas Penny, Vanessa Benjamin, Michael Glenn, Sonny Lasky, Ken Jackson, Casey Jones, Karen Carbone, James Konacek, Dolores King-Williams, Christopher Graybill, and James Lewis.
Jamie Ian McAllister and his wife, Kate, were both 15 years old when they were married in the river town of New Madrid, Missouri. They remained married and faithful and true to one another for 45 years. By the time Kate died in Jamie's arms after an outlaw raid on the Colorado town they had helped found, Jamie and Kate had produced a house full of kids and dozens of grandchildren and great-grandchildren. Jamie had already lived longer than many men of that time, but somebody forgot to tell Jamie about that. For a man his age, he was still bull strong and wang leather tough. His hair was gray, but his heart was young. He used eyeglasses to read fine print, but he sure didn't need glasses to shoot. The loss of Kate hit Jamie harder than anything ever had over the long and tumultuous years. For several weeks after her violent and untimely death, Jamie could not clearly focus on anything except her dying and the lonely grave overlooking McAllister's Valley. He holed up deep in the mountains and let his grief take control for a time. Jamie relived over and over each and every memory shared with Kate, the good and the bad, the laughter and the tears, the pain and the pleasure. The pleasure far outweighed the pain. After a couple of weeks, Jamie began to realize that Kate would not want him doing this. All the grieving in the world would not bring her back from the grave. She was at peace now, having climbed the starry path to be greeted by man above. She would wait there for him. Jamie looked up at the high, cloudless blue of the sky and buckled on his pistols, twin 44s, Model 60 conversion. He wiped the dust off his rifle, a Winchester Model 68. He tidied up his camp, packed the frame on the pack horse, and saddled up his big, mean-eyed horse, Buck. It was turning colder now, with winter not far off. During the weeks that Jamie had spent wrapped in his grief, those responsible for the attack on McAllister's Valley and the death of Kate, the Miles Nelson gang, would have scattered like dust in the wind. Any trail would be as cold as the stars.
I got a few good years left in me, and I'll use him finding you all. My son Matthew talks of book law and justice. Well, that's his way. I'll have justice my way. I'll find you all, and I'll kill you.
Jamie topped the crest and looked down at the town nestled deep in the Rockies. Another mining town. A number of buildings with boarded-up windows told him that already the gold or the silver was played out and the miners were moving on. What made him certain the town was dying was that among the empty buildings were several saloons. It was about 20 degrees above zero, with the ground covered with snow. Jamie wasn't sure, but he thought he had just passed the new year in a cave sitting out a blizzard. Dusk was settling over the mountains as Jamie went into the hotel bar and ordered a whiskey. Jamie spoke to no one in the bar, and no one spoke directly to him. Jamie had just lifted the glass to his lips when the front door banged open. Jamie had positioned himself so he could watch the front door by using the long mirror behind the bar. He watched two young men swagger in and belly up to the bar.
Howdy there, old-timer. My name's Pullen, Jim Pullen. You heard of me, I reckon.
Can't say as I have.
Oh, yeah? Well, you don't get around much, do you? Well, I reckon a man of your advanced age pretty much has to stay close to hearth and home. My part here is Blackjack Perkins. I know you heard of him.
Can't say I have, boy.
Well, he killed a man in Black Hawk, he did. Well,
I'm sorry to hear that. Terrible thing, having to kill a man.
Well, I killed my share of men, too. I ain't lost no sleep over it.
You're Jamie McAllister, ain't you?
That's right.
I've been hearing about you all my life. I'm sick of it. I don't think you've done half of what people say you've done. Now, what you think about that?
Come here, boy.
Yeah? What the...
Jerking one of the young man's guns from leather and holding the nearly unconscious Blackjack up between himself and Pullen, Jamie closed a few feet and laid the barrel of the gun against Pullen's head. Jamie popped Blackjack again. Blackjack joined his buddy on the floor for a nap. Jamie reached down with both hands and grabbed the sleeping young men by the backs of their shirt collars.
Somebody open that door. My hands are full.
Jamie dragged them to the door, then tossed them both outside. Yeah. Jamie signaled the barkeep for another drink.
Am I gonna have any more trouble here tonight? I didn't think so.
The entire town of Valley, Colorado, more than 500 people, were gathered around the steps of Goldman's Mercantile Store, where Matthews stood waving an opened envelope.
It's from Paul! It's a letter from Paul! Paul's well. He was in Central City when he wrote this. He's picked up the trail of some of the Nelson gang and was leaving out for Wyoming next morning.
What's the date?
There ain't any, Jolene. Hush up and listen.
Don't tell me to shush, you ox.
Shut up, both of you. Matthew, Reed.
There ain't much more, Jamie Ian.
Isn't.
Paul says to tend to Ma's gravesite and plant some flowers around about. He says if he comes back here and finds the site all grown up with weeds, somebody's butt's gonna be in trouble. That's it.
I wonder where Pa is now.
Jamie had bypassed South Pass City, giving it a wide berth and riding on toward Atlantic City. He'd heard that several of the men he was seeking were loafing around that mining town, gambling and whoring and making trouble. Jamie was about to put an end to all that. After the raid on McAllister's Valley, the Miles Nelson gang had broken up and scattered. The Pinkertons and Wells Fargo detectives, many sheriffs and town marshals all over the West, as well as federal marshals and the U.S. Army were after him. With the gold and money taken from the bank and the stagecoach, the gang members could live well for a couple of years. By then, the heat would be off them, they could regroup, or so they thought. But they hadn't taken into consideration one Jamie Ian McAllister dogging their trail, riding with hard revenge burning in his trail-wise eyes. When the gang had struck McAllister's Valley, the Nelson gang was the largest in all the West. Actually, there were five gangs, each with about 15 men, robbing and raping and looting and burning from Kansas to California. Miles had pulled them all together for the raid that killed Jamie's wife. 25 of the gang had been killed, wounded, or captured during the raid in the valley. That left about 55 outlaws still on the loose. 55 of the meanest, sorriest, most worthless dredges of humanity ever assembled. It had taken Jamie about 6 months to do it. but he had put together a list of men who were part of the Miles Nelson gang. To do so, he'd visited with every sheriff and marshal in every town he passed through, looking at dodgers and talking with men in lockup. Now, a rustler might steal your cattle, but when it came to raping and killing women, shooting little kids down in the street, that was going too far. So most of the men in jail talked to Jamie. Jamie had a list of 51 names, and if it took him the rest of his life, he was going to visit each name. After the visit, he would draw a line through that man's name. Jamie found the men in the first saloon he entered. They were sitting in the rear, a bottle of whiskey and two glasses on the table between them.
Hubby Joyner and Jesse Maxwell, stand up and face me, you murdering bastards.
The two outlaws stood up, hands hovering over the butts of their guns. They both had known that Jamie was after him. That news had spread all up and down the Hoot Owl Trail. But neither one of them had worried much about it. They were in their early 30s. McAllister's hair was gray. He had to be knocking on an old man's door. No way he was going to take two men half his age. Hubby grinned, exposing tobacco-stained and rotten teeth.
You best go on back home now, old man. Get in your rocking chair and pull the shawl over your knees.
Yeah, where'd you leave your cane, old man? You best find it before you fall over.
You men were part of the gang that raided McAllister's Valley last year. You killed a number of people, including my wife, Kate. Now hook and draw, you sorry sons of bitches.
There'll be money in their pockets. It belongs to Wells Fargo and to the bank in Valley, Colorado. Turn the money over to your marshal.
Jamie holstered his guns and the crowd watched in silence as Jamie unfolded his sheet of paper, took a pencil from his vest pocket. He drew a line on the paper, then carefully folded it and returned it to his inside pocket. A dozen or so reporters from back east gathered at Valley, Colorado. They had decided that if they were going to go traipsing around the Wild West where red savage Indians abounded, there was strength in numbers. Valley was a nice-sized town for the time and the place. It was a little off the beaten path, but quite a fine town once you got there. Mining, farming, and cattle and sheep ranching surrounded the area. The place had a weekly newspaper, the Valley Dispatch, and the visiting reporters were amazed at how professional the writing was. They were equally amazed at how damn many McAllisters there were in Valley. The mayor was a McAllister, Morgan. The sheriff was a McAllister, Matthew. There were five deputies, and three of them were related to the McAllisters. In addition, half the town council was related to the McAllisters.
You know, Connor, this has got to be the most mixed-up goddamn family I have ever seen in my life.
Shh, don't say that too loud. The way I have it figured is that there are approximately 324 people in this town related to the McAllisters. Hell, you never know who you're talking with. Look there.
The reporters turned to stare as Falcon walked in through the bat wings, dressed in a black suit with a sparkling white shirt and black string tie. Falcon was the spitting image of his father, with wide shoulders and arms so muscular his suits had to be tailor-made for him. Falcon's eyes were a pale, cool blue, and his hair was the color of wheat. While in town, he generally wore only one gun, low and tied down. Few people knew about the Derringer he carried behind his belt buckle.
As much as I enjoy the comforts, hanging around here isn't getting the story written.
We found two men who have agreed to guide us. One of them is with Lawrence now, buying the last of the supplies. Hopefully we'll be out of here mid-morning tomorrow. Check out this map. We'll ride to here, catch the train to here, then ride over to this place. That's where some of the Nelson gang is said to hang out.
Who says?
The guides, Connor. Does anybody have a better plan?
What's the guide's name?
One is called Hank. I believe he called the other one Newly, something like that. Nah, not Newly. It was Newbie, yeah. That's it. Newbie.
From Atlantic City, Jamie drifted down to Bear River City. Just 2 years back, it had been a booming town as the railroad pushed through. Now the town was rapidly dwindling. Many buildings stood empty. Jamie was playing a long shot. where the two men rumored to be holed up in or near the dying town might have left, or they might never have been there. But Jamie had time, and he would check out every lead, no matter how shallow it might seem. Jamie checked into the one remaining hotel, then walked across the street to the saloon. His eyes swept the large room as he walked to the long bar.
Beer, bartender. Fred Allison and Phil Howard, they been in here?
They just left, Mr. McAllister, when you rode in. Said they'd be waiting out in the street for you any time you was ready to die.
Suits me.
Jamie drained his glass and walked out the back door. He walked the littered alley and stepped out at the edge of town. His hands were filled with Colt's hammers back. About 50 feet from him, two men were standing in the street, yards apart, each of them carrying sawed-off shotguns.
Taking no chances, huh, boy?
The men whirled around and fired the shotguns. The heavy charges blowing off chunks of the building where Jamie had been standing. He hit the ground belly down and fired his Colts. One slug punched a hole in the belly of Phil Howard, doubling him over. As he went down, he pulled the trigger to the second barrel of the greener and blew off all the toes on his left foot. The other slug went high and caught Fred Allison in the throat, tearing a great hole in the back of the man's neck as it exited. Jamie walked over to the bodies and removed their money belts. He slung the money belts over his shoulder and picked up one of the sawed-off shotguns. It was a good gun, well made. Jamie took that and a sack of shells lying by the body. He then turned and walked up the street without looking back. Eastern newspapers had quickly picked up on Jamie's vendetta and assigned reporters to travel west and cover the story. A leading newspaper in Boston assigned a black reporter, at his insistence, to cover it. Ben Franklin Washington, unclaimed son of Ann Woodville, whose real name was Ann Jefferson, and whose parents were runaway slaves, was determined to stir up a hornet's nest. He knew his mother had abandoned him at birth, knew his sister had passed for white all her life, and was now married to one of Jamie Ian McAllister's grandkids. Ben knew his real mother, in cahoots with his uncle, had tried to have him killed in Richmond, Virginia. Ben Franklin Washington had no reason to love any member of his family. He was going to do his best to upset as many apple carts as he could, and he was going to love every minute of it. Ben arrived in the West with three other reporters, a photographer, an artist, a man who was gathering materials for a book he was writing on the Wild West, the sons of three wealthy industrialists from back east who came along for the adventure of it all. They left their wives behind and brought their girlfriends, a couple of gophers, several valets, two cooks, and four so-called professional mercenaries who were hired as bodyguards. They brought enough equipment with them to outfit a small army. They rode the trains as far as they could, then bought wagons, teams, riding horses, and hired men to drive the wagons.
It's all so, well, thrilling and grand.
It is that. What say you, Richard?
Oh, quite.
I must say, it's all rather primitive. I've never seen so many guns in my life.
I'm awed and overwhelmed and a little frightened.
I'll personally see that no harm befalls you, dear.
Oh, this fine land for the homesteading. New York City, you've seen the last of this Irish lassie.
Mary Marie O'Donnell was a flaming redhead with a scattering of freckles across her nose. Her family had come over from Dublin. She possessed more common sense in her little finger than the others did in their entire bodies. She took one look around her, and she decided she had made the right decision by agreeing to accompany Chucky to the Wild West. It was indeed a grand place. It was near and dark when Jamie topped the ridge and looked down at the small cluster of buildings standing around the larger structure that was the trading post. An army fort had just been constructed not far from the trading post. It had started out as Fort Augur, but recently changed to Camp Brown in honor of Captain Frederick H. Brown, who had been killed in 66 in the Fetterman Massacre. Jamie had to resupply, for he was low on some things and completely out of coffee, bacon, and beans. Jamie entered the low-ceilinged trading post and stepped to one side, as was his habit, carefully looking all about him, sizing up the half-dozen or so men sitting at the rough-hewn tables, playing cards and drinking snakehead whiskey. Now, some who made their own whiskey actually tossed in a few snakeheads during the curing process, claiming it added flavor to the brew. Jamie sat down at a vacant table.
You be Jamie McAllister?
I am.
The boys came from a table in a dark corner.
I got a message for you, McAllister. Call off your hunt.
And if I don't?
You'll not live to see summer turn to fall. You hear me, McAllister?
Oh, yeah, I hear you.
Look here, McAllister. Most of them boys you're a-hunting didn't put no lead in your wife.
They were there. They're all thieves, murderers, rapists, and worse. And I'm gonna see that every one of them steps up and shakes hands with the devil. Now leave me alone.
Miles Nelson says the killing of your wife was not done deliberate. It was an accident.
She's still dead.
God damn you, McAllister. Can't nobody reason with you about this thing?
No.
Then stand up, McAllister.
Were you with the gang that attacked Valley?
No.
Then I have no quarrel with you.
My name's Jones.
Oh, that's good, Jones. Everybody ought to know their own name.
My younger brother Lloyd rides with the Nelson gang.
I see. And you're gonna stop me from killing him, right?
That's right, McAllister.
Is he worth it, Jones? Really worth it?
He's my brother, McAllister. Now stand up and face me.
Jamie moved quickly. He grabbed a chair and threw it at the man. Jamie closed the distance between him and slammed a big fist into Jones's face. Jamie followed that with a left hook, then hit him twice more in the face.
God damn it! I'll stop you, McAllister. You'll not bring no harm to my little brother.
You stay out of it. Go on back home and keep clear of me. Your brother is riding with the worst of scum and filth. When you take up for him, that makes you no better. Don't you ever cross my trail again.
The next morning, Jamie headed straight west, crossing over into Utah. He camped along the Bear River for a couple of days, resting his horses, and then moved on toward the Mormon settlements just west of the Wasatch Range, along the Great Salt Lake. Four of Miles Nelson's men were in the area, hanging out somewhere between Ogden and Logan. And he had learned that four more of the gang were hiding out north of there, up in southern Idaho. They would be next on the list. Huddled around a fire, Lloyd Jones and four more members of the Nelson gang who were hiding out in southern Idaho were growing restless and surly.
Who the hell does this Jamie McAllister think he is anyway? Hell, he's an old man. He's got to be in his late 50s. I could take him with one hand tied behind my back.
Any of us could, Hewitt. This guy fought in the Alamo. Christ, I wasn't even born when that happened.
You got that right, Brennan. There can't be much to him. He's just an old man who thinks he's still tough. Hell, my brother's probably done put lead in him by now.
We're about out of coffee. I ain't gonna stand for being out of coffee. I'm tired of waiting around here hiding out like cowards. God damn it! I ain't no coward.
And I got to have me a woman. Let's mosey on down toward Utah and find us a farm woman. We'll take turns with her.
Her husband might have something to say about that, Brennan.
Hell, we'll just kill him right off. We might get lucky and find us a farm woman with some daughters. I like them young and tender. I especially like it when they fight and beg. That makes it better.
Damn, you're getting me all worked up. Think you got a real good idea.
Bad idea.
Who said that?
I didn't hear nothing, Lloyd.
I didn't either.
I could have swore I heard someone whisper from over yonder.
Shit, Lloyd. You just started thinking about women and that caused a roaring in your head, boy. Settle down and let's plan this here thing out.
Lloyd Jones looked all around him, then shrugged and returned to his spot by the fire.
I've been out here in the lonesome so long I'm losing my mind.
Don't fret none, Lloyd. You ain't crazy.
Jamie stepped out of the brush into the camp clearing.
McAllister!
Brennan grabbed for his pistol and whirled around, too late. Ah! He fell backwards, landed in the fire. His clothing burst into flame.
God damn it! Fuck you, McAllister!
Hewitt faced Jamie and managed to fire once, the slug knocking bark off a tree. Jamie shot twice. Meanwhile, a badly frightened Lloyd made it to his horse.
Go on, run, you bastard. There's always another day.
Jamie took the money belts from all the men, with the exception of Brennan. There wasn't much left to him. Then he took what ammunition he could use and stretched the men out in a row. He stripped the saddles from their mounts and turned the horses loose. Getting water from the spring, Jamie doused the fire and the smoldering remains of Brennan, and then dug a common grave under a huge old tree. Into the tree, Jamie carved the words, "Here lies four killers." Four days after the shooting in southern Idaho, a wild-eyed Lloyd, who was heading south, met the gang of adventurers and reporters and what have you on the trail as they traveled north.
It was awful. Me and my pards were just sitting around the fire, drinking coffee and jawing, when McAllister just stepped out of the brush and started shooting.
What's your name?
Lloyd Jones.
I'm Pat Reardon, federal marshal. You're under arrest for murder, rape, bank robbery, mail robbery, and anything else I might be able to dig up on you.
What?
Suddenly, one of the group of riders jerked a hog leg from under his coat.
I'll be damned if that's so!
The man blew the marshal out of the saddle.
Ride, Lloyd, ride!
Lloyd and the man left in a cloud of dust. A couple of reporters jumped down to aid the marshal, who had been shot in the side.
My Lloyd!
I'm all right. Give me a hand. I can ride. Now maybe you goddamn reporters will understand why marshals and sheriffs out here ain't interfering with Jamie's hunt. Them he's hunting ain't worth the gunpowder to take to blow their brains out. As far as I'm concerned, McAllister's doing the country a favor. Personal, I hope he kills every damn one of them. Now get out of my way! I gotta ride back to town and find a doctor.
This just might turn out to be a much more interesting trip than we originally thought.
Ben Franklin, Washington, raised an eyebrow.
I certainly hope so.
Jamie had vanished. Not one sighting of him was reported the rest of the summer. After he had buried the four killers, Jamie headed north, riding across the Snake River Plain and into the Sawtooth Range of Idaho. There, he holed up for 2 months, hunting and fishing and staying low. As autumn began painting the landscape with multicolored hues, many of the reporters returned to their home cities. There was just nothing to report about Jamie Ian McAllister. But two of the reporters, those who had taken the time to research the background of Jamie, knew what Jamie was doing, playing the waiting game. So Lawrence Douglas and Thomas Connor stayed. Ben Franklin, Washington also stayed. Ludlow, Farnsworth, and Bennett had to stay too, for their fathers had told them they had, by God, better bring back comprehensive reports on the feasibility of buying property, mining interest, and so forth. Their lady friends remained with them. The photographer stayed, as did the artist and the writer, John A. Bellingham. But the valets, cooks, and gophers were dismissed, as were the bodyguards. The so-called guides, Hank and Newby, pulled out one morning and were not seen again. On a quiet Saturday afternoon, September 1870, Jamie rode into a small settlement in southwestern Montana. The town consisted of a general store, a saloon, a crude livery, and a combination barbershop, bathhouse, boarding house, and cafe. The closest law was nearly 100 miles away. Jamie was looking to resupply, enjoy a hot bath and a shave. His beard was really beginning to itch. And to have a meal prepared by someone else. He had no way of knowing that some of the Miles Nelson gang had the exact same thought. Lounging in a huge tub of hot soapy water, Jamie passed the time reading newspapers that were anywhere from 3 weeks to 3 months old. But it was still news to him. Since he had left his valley, Wyoming had given the vote and the right to hold office to women. 2 months later, Utah Territory did the same. 5 years after the Civil War, Texas was readmitted to the Union. He was about to close up the newspaper when he noticed a small article in the back section of the Boston paper. The reporter's name was what caught his attention. Ben Franklin Washington. He carefully read the article. It was about Jamie's manhunt, and the dateline was 3 weeks back in Salt Lake City.
Good Lord, I believe I could use a drink.
There were a dozen men in the saloon, most of them ranch hands by their look, and a couple of tired-looking soiled doves. All heads turned as Jamie walked to the bar. He got a good once-over from the locals.
I'll just be damned.
You know that man?
Yeah, I sure do. That's Jamie McAllister. I rode through his valley some 20 years ago while I was scouting for the army. He treated us right nice, him and his pretty wife. Yeah, the whole valley of folks was friendly and nice.
Then it was his wife that the Miles Nelson gang...
Yeah, and that old war horse over there is on the prod for him. I hear tell he's already killed 8 or 10. I wouldn't want that man on my trail.
But did he really fight at the Alamo?
He damn sure did.
Hell, Davey, that man's a legend.
Sure is.
Outside of the bar, 5 men from the Nelson gang rode into the tiny town. Dismounting, men, all wearing long dusters, began their walk to the saloon. Jamie sipped a whiskey. It was the first drink he'd had in a couple of months, and he enjoyed the warmth of it. A grim-faced and unshaven man sat alone at his table and glared open and undisguised hate at Jamie. Some years back, Falcon had killed his brother over a dispute involving a game of draw poker. He reckoned one McAllister was as good as the next one. Now would be a real good time to settle the score. The man poured another drink of courage and swallowed it down, then pushed back his chair and swept back his coat, clearing the butt of his gun.
Turn and face me, McAllister! I said turn around and face me, McAllister!
Jamie turned around slowly, the glass of whiskey in his left hand. His right hand hung close to the butt of his Colt.
You got a problem, mister?
Yeah, I do. One of your cotton-headed bastard sons killed my brother. Now I'm gonna kill you.
Oh, I don't think so. Somebody might someday, but I've got things to do and places to go before that happens. Now sit down, Finley, before your ass overloads your mouth.
Suddenly, the bat-winged doors were pushed open, and the 5 outlaws stepped into the bar.
Draw, McAllister!
Finley went for his gun at the same time as the Nelson gang did. Jamie dropped the glass of whiskey and pulled his left-hand Colt, drilling Finley. Ah! Jamie turned toward the knot of outlaws at the bat wings. Jamie dropped to one knee to present a smaller target as the gang members began spreading out along the front wall. Jamie rose slowly to his boots and began reloading his Colts. The saloon emptied, but the 2 soiled doves took the time to rifle the pockets of the dead outlaws lying on the saloon floor.
Take what's in their pockets, and leave the money belts alone. That's stolen money.
The doves stood up and backed away. Jamie looked over at Finley. The man was still alive, but not for long. He was blowing pink bubbles, and that was an accurate signal he was lung shot. Jamie walked over to him and knelt down.
You know any of those men who jumped into our play?
2 of them. Boyd and Curly Mack. Nelson gang. You're good, McAllister. I'll give you that much. Do me a good turn?
What?
Hell, you killed me. You owe me that much. I got money sewed into the lining of my boot. Inside. You see to it, I get planted proper.
Reckon I can do that. Which boot?
But Finley couldn't reply. He was dead. Jamie rose and turned to the 2 women.
He's got money sewn in one of his boots. He wanted a proper burying. See that he gets it. I really don't give a good goddamn what you do with the others.
Roscoe Jefferson, who had changed his name first to Ross LeBeau and now to Russell Clay, was seated at a hotel cafe. He opened the Denver paper, adjusted his reading glasses, and carefully read the story about Jamie and the manhunt. When Russell glanced up, he was shocked right down to the soles of his handmade shoes to see his sister's child, Paige Woodville Haywood, walking into the lobby of the hotel, her husband with her.
Great God in heaven.
The handsome couple were across the room from Ross, with Paige's back to him. As soon as they passed, Ross left the cafe as quickly as possible, with as much dignity as he could muster under the circumstances. Now he had two relatives to worry about, Paige as well as Ben Franklin Washington, his snooping nephew. It was late September when the reporters learned of the shootout in Montana. By now they were wising up and made no plans to travel there. Jamie would be long gone. Much to the chagrin of Russell Clay, the reporters had shifted their base to Denver, where there were telegraph and rail services around the clock and more social activities available. Because Russell had paid informants scattered around the growing city, he knew that Lloyd Jones and his now outlaw older brother Bob, who had shot Marshall Reardon, were hanging around Denver's seedy section. He sent one of his most trusted men to arrange a meeting. Russell had made up his mind on how best to deal with the problem of his sister's half-breed children. That sister, now living in San Francisco and going under the name of Andrea Petri, read with much interest the greatly embellished newspaper account of Jamie's hunt for the Nelson gang. She laid the paper aside and shook her head. Kate was dead, and Jamie was on the warpath. She would follow this bizarre story closely. Next, Andrea read the reports of the private detective she had hired. Her daughter, Paige, and her husband, James William Haywood, the grandson of Jamie McAllister, had settled in Denver and were well and happy. She frowned, knowing that that was where her brother had settled. Andrea knew that if he felt threatened, he would not hesitate to kill to protect his identity. To make matters worse, Paige's brother, Ben Franklin Washington, was also in Denver, snooping around and asking questions. It was only a matter of time before he put everything together and went public with it. That would ruin Paige's life. Andrea couldn't have that, would not have that. She sent for some of the thugs she kept on her payroll. She would take care of this matter once and for all. Matthew McAllister was holding up a week-old newspaper. His sister, Jolene, read over his shoulder.
Pa struck again, Falcon. Took out 6 in one whack.
Pa ain't slowed down a bit, has he? That old he-coon is still a war horse.
Well, now, that's a hell of a way to talk about your father.
Wasn't no disrespect meant, brother. Anyway, I meant to tell you, I'm fixing to take me a ride to Denver. Keep an eye on Marie and the kids while I'm gone, will you?
Now that goes without asking.
Falcon grinned at her and jauntily tipped his hat. Jolene stuck out her tongue and took a swipe at him that Falcon easily ducked. Falcon left his brother's house and pulled out for Denver within the hour. The Central Railroad had reached Elko, Nevada in 68. And the town fast became a drop-off and pickup point for all the freight coming in for the region's mines. The area boasted large cattle ranches, and sheep were also being introduced, herded by Bosque sheepmen. But Jamie wasn't interested in local affairs, and he had no intention of getting involved in them. He was looking for 3 men he had been told were hanging around the town: Red Johnson, Waddy Keaton, and Bob Perlich. Jamie's hunt had been going on for months now, and the outlaws were well aware that they were being hunted, and they knew that Jamie had killed about 15 of their gang. That news was making many of them surly and very, very edgy. To a man, they'd all had detectives from Wells Fargo, Pinkertons, bounty hunters, county sheriffs, and federal marshals after them, but no one had ever followed them with the bulldog tenacity of Jamie Ian McAllister. It was downright irritating. Jamie checked his guns, worked them in and out of the holsters a couple of times, and headed for the seediest saloon in town. The stores on either side of the saloon were closed, and so were the stores across the street. The wide street in front of the saloon was deserted.
Whiskey, barkeep.
Jamie took the drink and moved to a rear table, sitting down with his back against the wall. He picked up a worn deck of cards to start a game of solitaire. Suddenly, the bat wings flew open and Red Johnson stood there, his eyes wild and his hands over his guns. Jamie drew his right-hand Colt and kept it out of sight by one leg of the chair.
Damn your eyes, Jamie McAllister! I ain't running from you no more!
Johnson's hands closed around the butts of his guns, and he started his pull. Jamie let him have it. Red stumbled outside, in front of his shirt blossom and crimson, and fell dead. Jamie laid his pistol on the table and took a sip of whiskey.
You hear those horses taking off, barkeep? That'll be Waddy Keaton and Bob Perlich. I guess those boys just don't have the stomach to face me. Another time, I reckon. You got anything to eat in this place?
Yes, sir. Got a stew my old woman just fixed, and some hot bread.
I'm bringing it. And a big glass of water.
Yes, sir. Right away, sir.
You killed a mighty fine man just then, McAllister.
I killed a piece of scum and a totally worthless trash. Now shut up and leave me alone.
Here you go, sir.
Jamie started eating with his left hand, his right hand close to the pistol on the table. The bold-speaking local started to head outside.
Now you leave that body alone. He's probably wearing a money belt filled with stolen money. The money belongs to the bank in Valley, Colorado, and to Wells Fargo.
What are you gonna do with it? Take it for your own self?
Jamie smiled at that. If the truth be told, Jamie was probably one of the richest men west of the Mississippi. He was worth millions of dollars. Ever since first settling in the valley, Jamie had been working gold mines, many of them lodes his grandfather had discovered in the latter part of the last century, when he first came out with the mountain men, and all during the 19th century, until his death in 1844. He was buried along the same ledge as Kate, high up overlooking the long valley.
You find something funny about that, McAllister?
Let it alone. Just let it alone.
Stand up, McAllister. I think I'll kill you.
Oh, shit.
I said get up, you son of a bitch!
Jamie ran the edge of the table into the man's belly. Jamie rose from the chair with an easy movement and popped Max on the side of his jaw. Jamie then reached down and took the man's pistol from the holster and tossed it on the table, out of reach.
Fuck this shit!
Max was crawling to his boots, his big hands balled into fists. Jamie hit him three times in the face.
Goddamn worthless piece of...
Jesus Christ.
Jamie picked up Max's gun and walked over to the bar, handing the pistol to the barkeep.
You can give it back to him when he cools down.
Yes, sir. I'll hide it away right now.
Jamie paid for his drink and food. Outside, Jamie ripped open Red's shirt, removed the money belt, then walked over to the bank to make arrangements to have the money sent to the bank in the valley. Falcon sat in his hotel suite in Denver and carefully read all the newspapers he'd bought. Papers from New York City and Boston and San Francisco and St. Louis. The article in the Boston paper, written by somebody named Ben F. Washington, particularly disturbed him. The reporter, while not coming right out and openly saying he hoped Jamie would fail in his manhunt, came damn close to saying it. Falcon decided if the day came when he ran into this Ben F. Washington, he might just jack his jaw a time or two. Maybe that would knock some sense into the man. Falcon dressed carefully and went down to the lobby, checking to see if James William and Paige had replied to the message he'd sent upon arriving in Denver. They hadn't. Falcon shrugged that off. Could be they were out of town. He decided to hail a carriage and go see for himself. Falcon stood for several moments looking at the darkened home just at the edge of town in a very fashionable neighborhood. The homes were set some distance apart, with lots of shrubbery and trees in the well-kept lawns. He saw the lantern lights of another carriage approaching and stepped behind a tree out of a cautious habit. Falcon stood in the shadows and watched a man step from the carriage, pay the driver, and then dismiss it. In the darkness, Falcon could see that the man was dressed in Eastern garb and looked to be in his mid to late 20s. But Falcon couldn't be certain of that. He froze as still as granite.
You've done well, sister. Very well for yourself. Not bad at all for a quarter-breed nigger gal. It's going to be amusing to watch your make-believe white world crumble all around you.
The man didn't linger. He started walking away, and Falcon followed at a discreet distance. He followed him right back to his own hotel. When the man was inside, Falcon approached the doorman.
That fella who just walked in, I could swear I know him, but his name escapes me.
Why, that's the Boston Reporter, sir. Ben F. Washington.
Do tell. Well, now, I guess I didn't know him after all.
The West is getting crowded, sir.
That it is. That it is.
Falcon followed Ben around Denver for several days, determined to get to the bottom of Ben's whispered comments in front of James William and Paige's house. He didn't learn much, except that it seemed to him that Ben had surrounded himself with fops and fools and shady ladies, with the notable exception of a red-headed, green-eyed young lady named Mary Marie O'Donnell. Even before he introduced himself, Falcon had taken an instant liking to Mary Marie. The Irish girl had a tongue on her that could be as sharp as a bowie knife and didn't mind at all using it. On several occasions when she was away from the group, Falcon had managed some lengthy conversations with Mary Marie. But he was very careful to make it clear right off that he was a married man and not looking for romance, just conversation. He never told her his last name, and she never asked.
Oh, no, sir. I am not the girlfriend of Chucky. But Chucky wants the others to think I am. It's all a game of pretend.
How about Ben F. Washington?
A man who had an axe to grind and someone's ox to gore. A troubled man.
Does he ever talk about himself?
No. As a matter of fact, whenever someone brings that up, he changes the subject. But the last time they spoke, he did let slip that one time he had ties to a family that used to live around Richmond, Virginia.
Waddy Keaton and Bob Perlich had taken out to the east, and that's the direction Jamie took. He had him a hunch that they were going to try to link up with that part of the Nelson gang hiding out in Utah territory. Snow covered the ground when Jamie rode into the Mormon-controlled area that Brigham Young called The Place. It was then called Deseret, and a short time later, Utah. Jamie had always gotten along well with the Saints, simply because he respected their ways and didn't condemn them for their practices. But he didn't want to do anything that might bring the Danites, the enforcement arm of the Mormon Church, sometimes called the Avenging Angels, down on him. But he needn't have worried. The Mormons he encountered were friendly, and for the most part, totally sympathetic towards Jamie and his manhunt. He learned that the Mormons had driven out the members of the Nelson gang who had been hiding in northern Utah. They were believed to be somewhere around the Fort Bridger area. Jamie found an old trapper's cabin that was in pretty good shape and decided to stay there for a time. He had detectives from San Francisco, Denver, and St. Louis working to find Miles Nelson, but the outlaw leader had vanished, going into deep cover. As the days grew colder and the snow deepened, Jamie sat snug in his warm cabin before his fire and talked to the dancing flames, occasionally glancing at the picture of Kate he carried inside the face cover of his watch. Meanwhile, in Denver, Marshal Henry Ludlow, Richard Farnsworth, and Charles Bennett had each received an identical wire from their fathers back in New York City. They were ordered to stay in Denver and open an office. Come the spring, they were to begin traveling Colorado territory in search of land and mining operations that might prove profitable to the corporation. At the end of the telegram were these words, "Your wives due to arrive next train." Well, that threw everybody in the group except Mary Marie O'Donnell into a panic. She found it hysterically funny. Chucky didn't share in the humor, and he kicked her out of the hotel, putting her on the street very near penniless. Falcon found her on the curbside, sitting on her luggage.
Can you sew?
Are you daft? I'm Irish, of course I can sew. What's sewing got to do with farming?
I beg your pardon?
Farming. You hitch up the horse to a plow and turn the ground a time or two. Then you plant the seeds. Then...
I do know something about farming, Miss Mary.
I want a piece of ground to call my own.
Who's going to farm it for you?
Who? Me. Who else? St. Pat?
Falcon smiled and wrote a short note on the back of an envelope. Then he hailed a carriage and began putting Mary's luggage in the rear boot.
Where are we going?
We're not going anywhere, but you're going to Valley, Colorado.
I am?
You are. Now get in, I'll see you to the stage.
If you think I'm going to be a kept woman, you are out of your mind.
Get in a damn carriage and hush up. Did I say anything about you being a kept woman?
No, but...
The McAllisters own Valley, and everything around it for miles and miles. One of my brothers will sell you a piece of land. You can sew at my sister's dress shop until you save some money and get you started. Now stop arguing and get in the carriage.
Ooh. Falcon picked her up as if she weighed no more than a butterfly and deposited her in the carriage. Ben F. Washington had exited the hotel and was standing just outside the doorway, witnessing the exchange.
You know, I have a nephew named Jamie E. III, and I'm gonna guess he'll take one look at you and start walking into trees. And by the time I get back to Valley in the spring, I'll wager that you two will be planning a summer wedding.
The day I marry some damn tightwad Scotchman, leprechauns will play the Star Spangled Banner on the pipes.
Driver, stage depot.
Ben F. Washington had not noticed the three burly men standing across the street, watching him, intently trailing him. But Falcon had. He'd spotted him several days before. After seeing Mary Marie O'Donnell off on the stage for Valley, Falcon returned to the hotel and sat in the lobby, pretending to read a newspaper. As shadows began to creep silently over the city, signaling that dusk was about to turn the day into night, Ben walked through the lobby and out to the street. Falcon laid his paper aside and followed him. Falcon had learned that James, William, and Paige had taken the train to New York City the very day that Falcon had arrived in Denver. They would be gone for a month at least, maybe longer. And maybe that was a good thing, Falcon thought. That would give him time to get to the bottom of whatever the hell was going on here. Ben was taking his nightly walk before dinner. Falcon knew the route he would take, for Ben had never deviated from it. Standing across the street and half a block behind Ben, Falcon spotted the three toughs when they swung in behind the reporter. Falcon quickly crossed the street and closed the distance just as the three thugs, nicely dressed, but thugs nonetheless, reached Ben and dropped a bag over his head and shoved him into a darkened alley. Falcon picked up a broken wheel spoke from the gutter and ran into the alley, swinging the hard wood. Falcon jerked the hood from Ben's head and slammed the reporter up against a brick wall. A .44 stuck up under Ben's chin.
My name is Falcon McAllister, mister. James William Haywood is my nephew. Now, you've been snooping around, muttering some damn odd words. You and me, Mr. Washington, are going to have a long talk. And you're going to level with me about what the billy hell is going on around here. And you're going to be truthful with me. Because if I suspect you're lying, I'm going to blow your goddamn head plumb off. Now, you understand all that, city boy?
Ben managed to nod his head, the muzzle of the .44 cold against his chin. Falcon eased the hammer down on the Colt.
Fine. I just knew you'd see it my way.
In Falcon's hotel suite, a pot of coffee on the table, Falcon listened with rapt attention as Ben F. Washington carefully recounted the whole sorry and sordid tale of his family's history, as much as he knew. When Ben had finished, Falcon poured a fresh cup and leaned back in his chair.
So Roscoe and Ann Jefferson became Ann and Ross LeBeau, the actors and singers and musicians. I often wondered what happened to them. So Anne is the mother of you and Paige?
Yes.
But you don't know Paige?
No.
She's done nothing to you personally?
No, nothing.
And she doesn't know she is a quarter Negro?
No.
Then why do you hate her so and want to destroy her life? Is it jealousy? Is that it?
Quite possibly. That is part of it.
You know, of course, that I will not allow you to ruin my nephew's life.
How would you stop me?
Well, that's easy. I'd kill you.
But you just saved my life.
Strictly to find out what in the hell is going on. I don't sympathize with you at all, Ben. Not one bit. You've got your own life, so why not just live it? And let others live theirs. You have no right to come along and destroy others just because you're angry at the hand life dealt you. If you want to live, just settle down and play your cards.
I can't believe you'd kill me, Falcon.
This is a family matter, Ben. And the McAllister family sticks together. You poke one of us with a needle, we all feel it. I will stop you from ruining two lives.
I don't believe you. I just don't believe you would kill me. Nonetheless, tomorrow I shall buy a pistol and learn how to use it. Thank you for what you did in that alley. Good night, Falcon.
Falcon sat for a time staring at the closed door. He knew what he had to do, but he damn sure didn't look forward to doing it. Restlessness gripped Jamie, and he couldn't winter in the cabin. He headed for Fort Bridger.
They've been here and gone, Mr. McAllister. Six of the hardest-looking men I've ever saw. They bought enough supplies to last the winter. I heard one of them call another Wadi.
Which way did they go?
Straight north, into the mountains. Give it up until spring, Colonel. This winter is shaping up to be a bad one.
I'll give it up when they're all dead.
Jamie rested his horses for a day while he resupplied, then pulled out, heading north. Jamie found an old campsite on his third day out and spent some time reading sign. When he finished, he knew a lot more about the men he was after. After studying the ground for a while, Jamie could now recognize their horses' hoof marks anywhere. There were six men, and one of them walked with a limp. None of them appeared to be very concerned about personal hygiene. They tried to hide the campsite, but either weren't very good at it or had made only a half-hearted effort to do so. He found part of a burned envelope with the name Terry recognizable. That would be Slim Terry, he was sure. Jamie hit the saddle and continued north. He put the muddy behind him and stayed on the west side of Commissary Ridge, heading for the trading post on the Ham's Fork. He was closing the distance between them by several miles each day. His friends among the Indians had spread the word about his hunt, and he was not bothered by it. He did wake up one morning to find a new set of buckskins laying beside his bed, and a fine tomahawk with the buckskins. The Utes, he was sure it was them, were leaving the outlaws alone, leaving them for Jamie. Jamie sighted the trading post and swung down from the saddle. He took his field glasses from his saddlebags and studied the place for a moment. The long, half-open lean-to that served as a stable was filled with horses. He had found Slim Terry and his bunch. Jamie rode up to the trading post from the rear, reining up behind the stable. He broke open and filled the twin barrels of the sawed-off shotgun with buckshot loads. At close range, the Greener was a fearsome weapon, capable of taking out two or three men with a single blast from both barrels. Walking around the stable, Jamie paused as the front door to the trading post opened and an old gray-bearded trapper stepped out. He spotted Jamie and walked up to him.
There's a smell of evil in there yonder, McAllister. Verity stinks it does. There's six of them and they's waiting for you. You need their help?
No, but I thank you for the offer.
I knowed your grandpair, and I knowed a Robidoux what took up with the Cheyenne and bred forth the woman who's the mama of Gentle Breeze. Your son treating her right, McAllister?
That he is.
I figured he must be. The Cheyenne had never stood for it if he wasn't a good man. Yeah. Anyway, that's two men sitting at a table just to your right as you step into the door. There's two more facing the door, backs to the rear wall, and the other two is along the bar. Now, that'd be to your left as you walk in. Now, take the two at the right side table out first, because they's the fastest, Wadi Keaton and Slim Terry. They's some other folks in there, but they's moved out of the way. Go in shooting. Good luck to you, Mac.
Well, thanks.
Jamie walked to the front door. He eared back both hammers to the sawed-off.
He went in fast and low, turning to his right. Six men in the trading post grabbed for their guns. The other men hit the floor. Jamie pulled both triggers of the greener. Waddy Keaton and Slim Terry got splattered all over the log wall. Dropping the sawed off, Jamie bellied down on the floor, his hands filled with Colts. Bob Perlich took a round in the belly and sat down hard on the floor. Willie Evans' lights were forever turned out as a .44 slug punched a hole in his forehead. Bonnie Rayburn and Jed Hudson ran out the back door and made it to their horses. But they left all their supplies behind. Jamie got to his boots and walked over to Perlich. He stood for a moment, then knelt down beside the man and reloaded his pistols. The other men in the large room were getting up, looking warily all around them.
You're a rotten son of a bitch, McAllister.
I've been called worse.
Miles will kill you, McAllister. You'll not get led in that man.
We'll see about that.
It wasn't in our plans to kill your wife, McAllister. We had plans to grab her and as many of Yorn and her daughters and use them up till we got tired of them. See, we had us a plant in your town feeding us everything that went on. How'd you figure out what we was gonna do?
A lucky guess, I suppose.
Well, Miles Nelson is sure to be hiring the top guns in the country, McAllister. I ain't gonna be around to see it. But he'll get the last laugh.
Jamie removed the money belts from the men. They were not as thick as when he first started his hunt, but still held a goodly amount of stolen gold and money.
The money's stolen. I'm sending it back as I find it.
The trapper Jamie had encountered outside poked his head in the door cautiously.
Over, huh?
Yeah.
Can I have a pair of boots? Mine's plumb wore out.
Hell, I don't care.
How about them pistols? Them's fine shooting irons.
Take them if you want them. I'll take their supplies. And the best of the pack horses. The rest of the animals you folks can sell or give away.
I appreciate it, Mr. McAllister. I surely do. You doing us a good turn, so I'll do you one. I know where some of the gang is wintering. There's a ramshackle of a mining town just across the territorial line in Colorado. It's in the Medicine Bows. Ain't much to it now. There never was no vein, but that's where you'll find five or six of the gang. Gambling and whoring, I expect. I also expect that's where them two that took out of here like their asses was on fire went. So you'll probably be up against, eight or so hard cases.
Thank you for the information.
Jamie took enough supplies to last him through the winter. He picked out the best of the horses and repacked what he was taking, which included almost 1,000 rounds of .44 caliber ammunition. He rode for several hours, reining up often to check his back trail. When he was satisfied he was not being followed, he made his camp in a snug hollow where he and the horses would be protected from the wind, and he spent the night. He would head for Colorado at first light.